So we've got the first questions coming up. Here we go. Dear Ajahn Brahm, thank you very much for giving us such a valuable bunch of teachings and a chance to practice. Thank you again. Now that's the sort of question I like. Very easy. And remember what I said on the first retreat about sometimes we don't know how to receive praise? I think I mentioned that before, didn't I? Yeah, you see, I deserve this. Okay, very good. Next question. Is it possible to experience full present moment awareness during the entire day of normal lay life? If so, to what extent? Can we live 24/7 in a state just short of jhana? Do enlightened beings live this way? If you live in full present moment awareness, 24 out of 7, you will not even know how to get to the toilet. Because you do need to, you know, be planned a little bit. Toilet's over there, and I've got to walk towards it. And I've got to lift up the seat, first of all. So you do need a little bit of future planning sometimes. So present moment awareness is what you especially do, you know, in your meditation. And there's many other times of the day you can do that. A lovely time is whenever you get stuck in a traffic jam. And when you get stuck in a traffic jam or at the red lights, just be there. So you can't go anywhere, you have to stay there. So instead of worrying, oh, I'm going to be late, that's going into the future. Or, you know, how much time I'm going to be here, that's waiting in the future. So you can't do anything when you get stuck in the traffic jams of life. So that's a wonderful time just to recollect where you are and be there and relax. Which is why, I've never seen this. This was something told to me a long time ago, and I wrote it in a book, but I've never actually seen it myself. People actually told me that in Delhi, in the any traffic intersections, instead of having stop lights, instead of STOP, they have the other words, RELAX. So when the light goes red, relax. So we don't, apparently they didn't call them stop lights in Delhi, they call them relaxed lights. Really, what a wonderful idea. However, when I went there, I couldn't find any, so it must have been just one of those nice ideas which never got any traction. But if anyone knows the Minister for Transport in West Australia, maybe we can actually do that. Instead of stop signs, relax lights. So those are times you can just be in the present moment. And especially when you go to bed at night as well. Don't worry about sort of what's happened so far in the day. Don't worry about what's going to happen tomorrow morning. It's a wonderful time to be in the present moment. So we can take many, many opportunities to be in the moment. In fact, you know, we can find heaps and heaps of opportunities. Not 24 hours every day, but a lot more than you're doing right now. Now, to what extent can we live 24/7 in the state just short of jhana? Just short of jhana, you've got this beautiful nimitta in there. You won't be able to sort of, you know, see sort of the wall there. You just see this beautiful nimitta. It's banging into things. You never know. You know, you wouldn't be able to find your mouth when you're eating because you wouldn't know where it is. You've just got no sense of body at all. Not even the arahats live in jhana all the time. So, you know, keep it natural. It's a nice little question, but that's not the way it is. Dear Ajahn Brahm, there are several instances in the Sutta Pitaka where ordinary folks listening to the Buddha end up as stream winners. For instance, 20,000 inhabitants of Rajaka became stream winners after listening to the Buddha when he delivered a sermon to King Bimbisara. Wow, wish we could do that these days. Imagine. Now, there's only 60 of you here and you know, you heard these sermons. How many of you became stream winners? And I've been talking all week. But then I'm not the Buddha, so. Sometimes, in some of those sutras, when they say 20,000, I think they are sort of exaggerating a bit. But anyway, some people became stream winners after listening to the Buddha when he delivered the sermon to King Bimbisara. Then there was Akiwesana, a disciple of Mahavira, who at the end of Buddha's sermon inside the boar's cave became a Sotapanna, while Venerable Sai Buddha became an Arahat while fighting the Buddha during the same sermon. That's a really nice place to go there, because you can go up to these places, the boar's cave, it's pretty clear that probably what they say is the boar's cave actually was the boar's cave where Venerable Sai Buddha became enlightened. And you just go and sit in there, you don't have to pay a fee. There's nobody at the gate there letting people in, you just go there and just sit, just like in the time of the Buddha, and that's really good energy. You're sitting there and think, wow, one of the great teachers also sat where you're sitting and became totally enlightened. So that's really, really inspirational to go to those places. Anyway, also, No, it's a case of Super Buddha the leper, who was born as a leper after spending eons in the hell realms for ridiculing a Pacheka Buddha. That's a Buddha who doesn't teach, referring to him as a leper, a beggar who picked the garbage cans, listened to the Buddha, and at the end, no garbage cans, it must be garbage baskets, listens to the Buddha, and at the end of his sermon becomes a stream winner. It is true that when a Dharma is preached by the Buddha, it is a very powerful effect on the listener. My question is, except for Vamasariputta, most of these folks have never practiced meditation in that existence. Isn't it they developed almost instant samadhi, which was so powerful enough to abandon the five hindrances, and momentarily see the unconditioned state? Does this mean if one repeatedly contemplates on Anicca, Dukkha, Anatta for a considerable period of time, the possibility of reaching the samadhi state exists? Thanks, Ajahn. So what you're really asking, can you sort of take a shortcut to stream winning without doing a jhana? And it is true that sometimes in those suttas you just hear that people, they no mention of actually meditating, not even any mention of keeping precepts. These are all people here, they don't mention they took five precepts or eight precepts. So some people might answer, well, all you need to do is listen to the Buddha. I don't need even to sort of give up alcohol. I can have a few mistresses on the side. I can sort of cheat on my taxes, because it says there, you just need to contemplate the Dhamma, and then you'll get stream winning. Unfortunately, it's not quite like that, because when they have these sayings or these teachings in the suttas, what they're doing is just getting that final little glimpse, the important part of a long, long series of events. And I've given a simile, the best simile I can think of, is when I've gone to people's houses, you often see photographs, maybe of their children, especially when they got their degree at university. And you see those pictures there. There's your daughter, and she's got this funny hat on. And it's only time you wear a hat like that, you know, with a flat top, and a black robe. And she's receiving this scroll of paper, you know, all rolled up, from this important dignitary. And that's all it is. So if you didn't know any more, you think, wow, that's all you need to get a degree. Just rock up to some university at the right time, dress in the funny clothes, and then this guy will give you a degree. Because that's the only thing which is recorded, that final event. Because that's the time, the culmination of all this hard work and studies and examinations and doing assignments. And now it's the final thing. And that's why we take a photo of it. So many of those stories of where people became stream winners or even fully enlightened, you know, like the famous one, Bahya, became fully enlightened just after listening to a short sermon by the Buddha, very short. That was just like the final photograph when you finally received your degree at the end of a long period of practice, which didn't just include jhanas, also included your precepts as well. So a lot of times people look at these and say, oh, it proves you don't need jhanas to become a stream winner. And you can also say, well, the precepts aren't mentioned also, so it doesn't prove you don't need to keep precepts to become enlightened. But the thing is, you do, because this is the last snapshot, the straw which broke the camel's back. But if you just put a straw on a camel, that doesn't break the back. It's just the last little piece in the jigsaw, and that's usually what is focused on there. But it is true, I mean, the Buddha was an incredibly special person, so maybe, you know, the Buddha had something, powers, so you didn't really need to get these deep states of meditation. Fortunately, there's no Buddhas around these days, so you have to get the jhanas. You're just born too late to get the shortcut. Yeah, another Sotapanna one, stream winner. If you attain stream winner in your last life, how do you know in this life that you are already a stream winner? P.S. We like it very much at Jhana Grove. Can we stay, please? Of course you can stay here. You can stay here as long as you like. But after a couple of weeks, there's an increase in cost. You have to shave off all your hair, wear brown robes, and then you can stay as long as you like. No, you can stay longer if you wish. So anyway, if you attain stream winning in your last life, how do you know in this life you're already a stream winner? This is one of those questions the monks have talked about. And when you're born, you don't know you're a stream winner. When you're born, you're like a baby, like anyone else. But if you were a stream winner in the last life, some, you'll obviously be a really good person, you gravitate towards meditation and Buddhism, and because of your last attainment in a previous life, you have to reattain that in this life. So in other words, you get that same insight in this life that you had in the previous life, so that you can carry on again. So when you're young years, you're not a stream winner when you're a baby, even if you were sort of a stream winner before the previous life. Oh, this is another thing over here. Here we go. I heard mention the unconditioned. What's that? Nibbana isn't the process to cease condition. It is cessation itself. Is cessation itself conditioned? Should we get our head around that? I can't even get my head around it. I don't know about you guys. Thank you for teaching us the full Dharma, even us lay people can get awake. The unconditioned. Now this is a famous quote in the suttas, in the Udana. Now the Udana is not central in the suttas. This is one of the less famous of the parts of the Tripitaka. This is not the core teachings, it's one of the edge teachings. But nevertheless it's in there and it's so often quoted. There is an unborn, an unconditioned, an unoriginated, blah, blah, blah. And people think, wow, and that's called Nibbana. Think, wow, now this is really interesting. There is an unborn, there is an unconditioned, there is sort of an unoriginated. And they get all sort of excited. Ah, you know, this is like what happens when you're enlightened. There is something when you become enlightened. And so many people have quoted that, not realizing that that is not really a very good translation. That's like a wishful thinking translation. The best translation, I was just talking this with Ajahn Bhamani just a couple of days ago, he said there is an escape from the condition, there's an escape from the born, there's an escape from the originated. That's a much better translation. But to understand what I mean, I got a simile from English literature, and it was from the story of Alice in Wonderland, and I put it in the book Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, or Happiness Through Meditation, the Singapore version, that Alice managed finally to get to see the Red Queen. And the Red Queen just asked her, on the journey, did you see anybody? And he said, I saw nobody on the journey. No, he said, did anyone pass you? Because she was waiting for the messenger. He said, nobody passed me on the road. And he said, well, that actually makes a lot of sense, that nobody passed you on the road, because actually nobody arrived here before you. And then the messenger came and said, did you see anybody on the road? I saw nobody on the road. Yes, Alice saw nobody too. But actually nobody got here before you. And the messenger said, yeah, nobody got here before me. That means nobody walks faster than you. And it all got really confusing, because in this little way of speaking, like nobody became a person. And that's interesting how we can take a nobody, which means the absence of a person, and make it into something. And the other story, which was also funny, I have to teach you a little bit of Pali, like dialect of Sanskrit. There's actually a word in Pali that means there isn't any, and that's called natti. So, you go and ask Bianca, is there any more sort of cheese left? And she says, natti. No, there isn't any. The monks have eaten it all. So that natty means there isn't any. So this is a story of one of the chief monks of the Buddha, Aniruddha. And when Aniruddha, in his previous life, he had such enormous meritorious karma that in this life, because of the karma, all his generosity in the past, in this life, if he wanted something, he had to receive it. So any material thing he wanted had to come to him. So that one day he was playing marbles with his friends. This was 2,500 years ago. And he was a little boy. And he was betting his lunch, which was like little cakes he got from his mum for lunch. And he kept on losing them, like gambling at marbles. So he was a very wealthy young man, so he sent his servant, now go back to mum and get me some more cakes. So the servant went back home quickly, got some cakes so he could carry on gambling with his friends, but he lost them as well. So he sent the servant back, please get me some more cakes. And the servant came and brought him some more cakes. Obviously, I'm having a very bad run of luck because he lost those too. So he sent the servant back a third time. And the mother said, natty cakes, you haven't got any. So the servant had to come back with the basket. And because if his previous karma, there's no way that he could actually be disappointed and not get something which he really wanted. That the heavenly beings, the devas, the angels, had to intervene to make sure the law of karma worked. So they secretly put these heavenly cakes in the basket. You know, these are cakes which the angels are supposed to eat, according to this myth. So they put the heavenly cakes in the basket, but the servant didn't know that. He brought the basket back and Aniruddha said, got any more cakes? And he said, natty cakes. Means me there isn't any cakes. And he gave the basket to Aniruddha. He looked in there. Oh, these are very nice. I haven't had these before. He started eating them. These were heavenly cakes. This is beautiful. Why hasn't my mother given me any natty cakes before? I really love these natty cakes. And that was a little funny story over in the suttas about the story of Aniruddha and how no cakes, you know, because of the intervention of devas, became a special type of cake which is very delicious, natty cakes. So what's happening here, you can see, because of the way of language, we take no cakes actually to be something, no body to be a person, and unconditioned to be a thing. Well, really it means the absence of all conditions, the absence of anything brought together. The unborn is not a state, it means the absence of birth. Now, when you put it that way, you understand why, yes, this nirvana is a cessation. It's not a state you go to. It's not, as I once called it, the ultimate retirement home, where you can retire happy ever after. It's not a place or a place of existence. So be careful there. Because everybody just wants, oh, well, I've worked so hard, and finally I've got enlightened. You mean I can't get reborn and enjoy it? That's the whole point behind it. And now one of my other stories to actually explain what the meaning of life is. Now the meaning of life. And when maybe 3 or 4 years as a monk, used to get people coming to visit our monastery in Thailand. And a couple of people came from San Francisco. And we were talking to them and they described this little curio which was very fashionable in San Francisco about 30 years ago. And again, if anybody sees one of these, you know, in some antique shop or some junk shop, you know, it's actually that, you know, I don't usually ask for anything, but if you can find one of these, I'd love to have one. Just to show people, because it's a beautiful, beautiful little thing. It was just a metal box. If actually you, you know, you haven't got one, maybe you could actually make one for me, because I'd love to show this to people. It's just an ordinary metal box, you know, flat on all sides. Except that you just had one little switch, you know, the old switches. And you put it on your coffee table, and of course people say, what's that? You say, switch it on and see. And so they turn the switch, and as soon as the switch, the batteries would power some sort of little motor, and cogwheels would start turning. And from the side of the box, a little flap would go up. And from out of the flap came this mechanical arm. It would go out, around, to the front, and then turn off the switch, and then go back again. It was a box whose whole purpose was to turn itself off. And that's all it did. And I thought, now that is the meaning of life. Your job is actually to turn yourself off. So if anyone can make one of those for you, I'd really love that. So that's actually nirvana. Any questions about that one? Okay. The other day when you scared us about dying, I decided to stay in the hall. When I said the bed is the most dangerous place. After a long time doing the breath meditation, my mind was calm and peaceful. There was no bodily feelings. I felt that the mind was inside a frame, watching another kind of mind outside. This object was like a square hanging down. I felt emptiness. I was in this state for a long time. There was no will to come out. Finally, when I came out, it was midnight. But I was not afraid. The fear has gone. Could you please comment? Did you go back to bed? Carry on. That was very good. You see, sometimes I say these things just to get, you know, to stay a bit longer in the meditation hall. It's only a joke about, you know, dying in bed. You can die anywhere. But, you know, people mostly die in bed, but it's usually because they're sick when they're in bed. But you're okay. But nevertheless, somebody just stayed a bit longer And they did the breath meditation. Of course, they did it a bit longer. It built up enough peace. Remember, I was saying, make peace, be kind, be gentle, be patient. If you keep building that up and up and up and up, sure that something's going to happen. So they're doing it all day, and it came to the night time, and yeah, you sort of got this very beautiful mind state, very peaceful. Now, when it had this idea of inside a frame, watching a kind of mind outside, the objects was like a square hanging down, I felt emptiness. The actual visualization of a square or mind looking at a mind, that's not so important, because this is just the way that perception actually tries to understand what's happening. And you know, when people tell me that, those sorts of details, I just don't really care about those, because we all have different ways of interpreting it. But what I really like is say the emptiness, there was no will to come out, and just nice and peaceful and beautiful. So that's a really nice state of samadhi. So well done, great. And when you came out, it was midnight, you're not afraid, and the fear has gone. Of course fear has gone, because afterwards the hindrance is disappearing. That's usually what happens. So afterwards, but what you should really do there is don't just go to bed straight away, make use of that little state. And just ask, what was it? You know, you find out for yourself, what was missing, especially when you get into deep meditation states. Maybe not try and find out what was there, but what was missing. It's a much better way of investigating. So don't try and say, what did that state feel like? Say, what wasn't there when I was in that state? What was absent? Because that's where you get great insights from. And it also tells you what sort of state you were in. Or you can say, what's my earliest memory? And see if you can get your past lives. It's a brilliant thing to do. So well done. In my sitting meditation this afternoon, I went into a deeper meditation state where all thoughts disappearing and the mind experienced a sense of being frozen. The more I tried to let go, the more I sensed deep inside me that I'm afraid of losing myself. Though I consciously look for the sense of knowing, one present moment awareness to ground myself. I do not know whether this is the right thing to do. I want to venture into the realm of letting go, as I have faith in Ajahn's teachings. When we truly let go of everything, are we also let go of our mind and our awareness? Kindly advise. Thank you. You see, people are getting nice meditation now. Is that making some of you sick? All these people get these nice meditations and it's not me. Oh, it's unfair. Don't worry. Because usually on the last evening of a meditation retreat, I remind you of the story of Ananda. Remember that story? He was the attendant of the Buddha. And he'd been with the Buddha for about 25 years of the last 25 years of the Buddha's life. Listening to all these amazing teachings. And he was there when the Buddha gave his teachings and this person became enlightened and that person became enlightened. 20,000 people became enlightened. But not him. And you can imagine how much that must have pissed him off. All these people, he's just doing all the work and being with the Buddha and all these other people getting enlightened, but not him. But now he was really working hard. So when the Buddha died, before he died, he cried. He thought, what's the chance of getting enlightened now? The Buddha's gone. But the Buddha did actually say, don't worry, it'll happen. You know what I sort of say? Just don't worry, just keep, make peace, be kind, be gentle. It'll happen one day. Just don't be patient. But anyway, a few months later, they had a meeting of 500 monks to actually get all the teachings together. And they wanted to find out which 500 should it be. So they chose all the great sort of heroes, the people with psychic powers, you know, people like Mahakasapa, and 499 of them were fully enlightened arahats. They decided to invite Ananda because he knew so much. He was with the Buddha for such a long time, and he was only a stream winner. So imagine that was you. Tomorrow morning, you have this meeting with all these great enlightened beings, and you're the only one who ain't. Similar, if I told you and made an announcement that of all the, actually 59 people on this retreat, 58 of you are fully enlightened with all the psychic powers, and you are the one who isn't. Oh, that really hurts. So Ananda, you know, was so embarrassed. Tomorrow morning we go to this meeting with his 500 arahats, and 499 arahats, and he was the odd one out. So what he did, he said, right, this is it, enlightenment or bust. He stayed up all night, no sleep, sitting, walking. He really gave it everything. What happened when the dawn came up? Nothing. Same as always. So it was really depressing. He'd really tried and nothing worked. So what did he do? He just decided, well, the meeting's not for another hour or two. I'll go and have a nap. So he went to his room and, according to the legend, before his head hit the pillow, he became fully enlightened. We call that the Ananda method of enlightenment. And you've been trying that many, many times in the retreat. Laying down. Doesn't work. Get up again. Lay down again. Doesn't work. But the reason it worked was because he let go. He gave up. He abandoned any hope of getting enlightened. 25 years with the Buddha, this all night, giving everything you got, nothing worked. Look, it's not going to happen. I'm going to let go. That's why he became enlightened. Because he really, really, really let go. So this is what we do. When we venture into the realm of letting go, it really means a full letting go. So you went deep in meditation, all thoughts disappearing, and you started to get frozen, but you were afraid of losing yourself. Don't try to lose yourself. Just let it happen. If you try, it never works. If you give up, surrender, just, oh, it's just hopeless. Me getting enlightened, no way. Then it might work. So let go of your mind and our awareness. Yeah, let go of everything. Awareness still stays, but you let go of it. Ajahn Brahm, could you please explain the relationship between letting go and what discussed in this morning talk? Yeah, letting go, I had to four types of letting go, four ways of letting go, looking at letting go from four different angles. Remember those? How good your memory is? What's the first one? Generosity mean giving, expecting nothing back in return. Did it work? Did you expect it to work? It's helping. But be very careful, it's so tricky. Having no expectations so you can get something. So that's expectations. And the second one? Throwing things away. How much did you throw away today? Or did you get more stuff today? Have you accumulated more? And the third one? Free. And what's the trick of being free? Being happy to be here. Where you are, yeah. This is good enough. I'm here. So no complaints. No one listens anyway. So just might as well be happy to be here. And the last one, non-stick mind, yeah, very good. So that's actually four ways of understanding what letting go really is. Last night it was said that the bhikkhunis have to be chaperoned in case they meet a male, even at this retreat. This is the rule when, then how did Bhikkhuni Satima get here from America? It seems she travels by herself. She doesn't travel by herself. When she goes on the aircraft, there's about 200 other people with her. That's why sometimes the people ask me, you go to Singapore, Malaysia, other places, and why didn't you bring an attendant? Why bring an attendant? There's about sort of 10 or 15 on the aircraft to attend to me. Just press the button and they come. And actually they're much more reliable than sort of, you know, mic attendants. Because they're paid, they have to be. So that's why, you know, they have had a chaperone there. And yet, why does a monk need a chaperone or a nun need a chaperone? You know why? Because sometimes there you are sitting alone together for a long time. Maybe even talking about Dhamma, but who knows what you're really talking about. So because of that, there's always people who are malicious and they look at, you know, two people like Sister Satima sort of, you know, talking with a nice looking young man and they think, Sister... And always people are like that because of all the movies you've seen and all the sort of the stuff you've seen on the TV or the soap operas and the books and stuff. So because of that, just to make sure that you don't make any bad karma by having malicious ideas or suspicions which don't turn out to be true, we just make sure that we're not just pure in our behavior, we try and be beyond suspicion so that nothing actually can happen. So when I do those interviews, it's out in the open there, so people can actually see. And if I went into the imagine I went into the room and did private interviews behind locked doors, who would know what was happening in there? And always be suspicions. Why is it, Ajahn Brahm, you always spend so much time with that pretty young girl? He's got lots of problems. Yeah. So you've got to be careful on this thing. You've been a monk a long time. Because you actually keep the rules, it's much you don't get into trouble. How does one become aware, get to know that one has reached 1, 2, 3, 4 jhanas, or one is a stream winner, one's returner, etc.? And if one knows, how does one go from one stage to another? If you're being a stream winner, how does one know what to do to become a one's returner? Okay, how does one become aware that one has reached this or that jhanas? After you come out of these jhanas, inside of them, you can't know what particular jhana it is. Your mind hasn't got enough width to actually to understand too much of what's going on. You're aware, but your awareness is frozen. So it's a totally different type of awareness. Blissful, frozen, but not have the width to really discern what's going on. But when you come out, it leaves a huge impression on your mind, a very powerful experience which you can't forget. Especially just afterwards, it's so easy to look at that state, and as I said, what was missing? And from what was missing, you can find out what that jhana was, or whether it was a jhana. If you can hear sounds, that's not a jhana. If you can feel feelings in the body, that's not a jhana. If the mind is thinking, not a jhana. If you can ask the question, is this jhana? It's not jhana. You can't ask anything. So you find out from afterwards. And how do you know as a stream winner, once returner without a teacher? That is the most difficult. Jhanas are pretty easy to know. But being a stream winner, once returner, non-returner, arahat, that's tough. And for those of you who don't know, how many of you have read Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond or Happiness Through Meditation? Put your hand up. It's actually less than half, okay. Do you know the story of when I became enlightened? Do you want it here? Okay. My fourth year as a monk in this lovely monastery in northeast Thailand. And I was really getting into my meditation. It was simple, no duties at all, very few duties. Simple. And just one evening, just my mind was just so still, it was flying. And just now, after the 9 or 10 o'clock, no way do you want to go to bed, because your mind was just so peaceful. I was doing walking meditation. And as we were doing walking meditation, just these insights started coming in. My mind was just so acute, so sharp. All these amazing insights, things you don't see normally, because your mind is too unclear and too many hindrances. Hardly any hindrances there at all. I couldn't see any hindrances. And all these amazing insights were coming. It was incredible. And then, the big one came. Wow, that blew me away. Enlightened at last. And oh, it was just so nice. It was just a shame it didn't last that long. It wasn't really enlightenment, but I really thought I was at the time. And it was just, all the things which I read about were there. I mean, it was just perfect peace of mind, so poised and so still, nothing hindered you at all. I did go back to my hut maybe about 2 o'clock, just to lay down for about half an hour, stretch the body, but no sleep. Usually you have to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. I was in the hall 2:30, just meditating, perfect posture, no trouble at all, no thoughts coming in the mind, no sort of agitation, just perfect samadhi, perfect stillness. It was lovely. Usually at that time in the morning, because I mentioned before, sleep deprived, malnourished, and bad climate, usually you're always nodding. This time it was just perfect. And when we did the chanting, you had all this energy to do the chanting, and it was just so wonderful being enlightened. And then we went on arms round, as we always do as a monk, and I was just giving all this incredible metta to all these people, because they really get lots of good karma giving to an arahat like me, fully enlightened. And it's flooding them with stuff. So how lucky you people are. And then when we got back to the monastery after alms round, I saw that day was different. We had 2 pots of curry. Usually we just have 1 pot of curry with our sticky rice. And usually the pot of curry was always the same every day. It was rotten fish stew, pardek. And, the fish, you're always laughing, you know what it's like. is they kept the fish, you know, from the monsoon season, the rainy season, and they get these earthen jars, they just bung them in there and put like a piece of plastic on the top with a rubber band and leave them, you know, to go off. And they stank. And one of the stories, to tell you this, give you an idea, in one of the monasteries I was cleaning around the kitchen, you know, doing some work to look after the monastery in which you live, and I saw one of these jars, you know, of the rotten fish, and the plastic had been penetrated, it was torn, and the flies had got in, and it was quartered with maggots. So, you know, I picked it up to throw it away. And that's when the Puyai Bam, the headman, saw me. He said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Look, it's, you know, it's gone off. You've got the maggots in. I'm throwing away." "Don't you dare. That's extra protein." And that's what we ate the next day. That was really disgusting. Now, I'm describing this. It was disgusting where it came from. It looked disgusting. It smelt disgusting. And also, it tasted disgusting. That's all you had to eat. You know, you just ate it. It was like poor people's food. So in having the pladek curry every day. But this day there were two pots. I just couldn't believe it. The other pot was actually a pork curry. Now I was a vegetarian before I became a monk. But you know, you just couldn't do that in the North East. You had to eat whatever you were given. And the pork curry, you know, was actually, I wouldn't say it was delicious, but it was edible. And so straight away when I thought that, I said, "This is amazing. The heavenly beings have noticed that I've become fully enlightened. And they decided to celebrate by giving me this delicious curry." So I thought, "Wow, thank you so much, heavenly beings." So there was the two curries there, and we had our rice in our bowl. And I was, even though I was only four reigns, I was the second monk there. And so the abbot, you know, he took his first. It was like self-serve. So he got this big pot of pork curry, and he had these ladles. And I just couldn't believe how much of this pork curry he put in his own bowl. Three huge ladlefuls, not spoons, ladle, almost like buckets full. But I didn't mind at the time, I thought he was a greedy pig, but there was plenty left for me. But what he did next was really over the top. He picked up the remainder of the pork curry and he poured it into the rotten fish curry and stirred it up. And as he was stirring up, he said, "It's all the same anyway, it's all the same anyway." I said, "Bloody hypocrite. You say it's all the same. You should have mixed it up before you took yours. You know, you didn't take any of this rotten fish curry, and you're a local boy. That's what you've been eating all your life. Why didn't you take that? You like that. And now you put my beautiful pork curry in the rotten fish curry. You spoiled my whole breakfast, you pig." And I was really upset. I was really angry. And that was the point I realized, oh no, enlightened people don't get angry. And that was one of the most depressing moments of my life. You know, to think you're enlightened one moment, the next moment realize you're not. That's really a downer. And so I just put in a spoonful of this curry. Passed it down. I didn't matter what I ate now. I was so depressed. That's a true story. But what it taught me is just how easy it is to think you're enlightened. And if it wasn't for that sort of monk actually mixing the two curries together and really spoiling my meal, I would have noticed it. So thank you for doing that. So if anyone here thinks they're enlightened, tomorrow with their breakfast or their lunch, pour something they don't like on the top and see what they do. And if they go, "What are you doing?" "Ha ha ha, I caught you out." So that's actually how you usually find out if a person's enlightened or not. But you've got to be careful. It's a difficult one to find out, because what happens is there you get some defilements or attitudes, wrong views get overcome. You've got to wait for a long time to see where they come back again. So if ever you do get a wonderful experience, don't go around telling other people you're a screen winner. Wait for a while and see if that state lasts. And really, best not to tell anybody, maybe your teacher. Even your teacher will say, "Well, just wait and see what happens." It's so difficult to say. And if it's like a non-return or an arahat, you know, the anagami or arahat, the fully enlightened, that's very easy to find out. Usually to see if you have any anger left. Because anger is so easy to see. Lust is sometimes hard to see. You know you have lust, but anger is just so evident to everybody. So usually what happens if someone comes along and says they're a non-return or a fully enlightened, the teacher tries to really make you upset, make you angry. You're only a woman, you can't get enlightened. And that really upsets people. And if they get upset, I look at them. And if they get upset, I say, I'm sorry, you're not enlightened. You do anything more ugly like you can't get enlightened. What you do is you try and upset them and see if there's any anger left. And if there is, they're not enlightened. So this is some of the tests to find out. So if you get enlightened and you find you get angry, it's another downer, like when I had the anger with that monk who spoiled my pork curry. Many thanks for last night's answers from the bhikkhunis, especially Ajahn Wayama's. I found her answers to the questions a great reminder of how much we miss her Friday night teachings at Dhammaloka. Yeah, no, because she's not that healthy, but it's wonderful she answered a few questions. She's getting better and better and better with all your care and all of your merit sharing with her. She may get better and 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 better. Might as well go over the top, sister. Much of meditation's nurturing and supportive infrastructure that is fostered in the Sangha does not exist in the home life. To realize such an environment, to maximize meditative potential, one may wish to exchange his necktie for robes and become a monk. What are the minimum applicant criteria to become a monk at Bodhinyana Monastery? You have to still be breathing. And what defines how much time is spent training in each monastic category, such as anagarika, novice, and fully enlightened? Fully ordained, sorry. So usually what we do, if anyone really wants to become a monk or a nun, you go and visit the monastery, you stay a short time first of all, so say like a month, just as a visitor, or a couple of weeks, and you go back again, and then you come back again, usually. So you test it out, and the monastery tests you out to see whether you fit in. There's not many people have romantic ideas. Yes, I'm going to become a monk. I'm going to become a nun at Dharamsala. I'm just going to let everything go. And I'm just going to sit there and meditate all day and just have such a peaceful mind. And then you just get the job of cleaning the toilets. And say, I didn't become a nun for this. Because you don't really know what it's like to be a monk or a nun until you give it a try. But then you sort of find out if you like it, and if you really like it, then you can actually take an anagarika ordination, if you're like a man. And I think they have another anagarika ordination in Dharamsala. And usually, 1 year as an anagarika, this is roughly, but then after 1 year, if you really want to become a novice, then you ask, and the Sangha looks at you and says, well, is it the right time? And if they all sort of think, he's a really great person, we ordained him as a novice. Another year as a novice, minimum, sometimes more. Until you feel, then it's the right time to become a monk. So we do a slow introduction to monastic life. And a lot of times that I've had enough experience of this that I really don't know who's going to make it or not. Because there's some candidates I thought, no way in the world are they going to make it. And they do, and they're still monks years and years afterwards. And there's some of these whiz kids that come into the monastery and I thought, wow, this is the place for them. They're such a good person. And then they leave. So, I've had that so many times. You don't really know, you can't know. And there's other people, for example, there's been some gay men who become monks, and when they first became a monk, I thought, gee, are they going to survive in a community of men? And they did brilliantly. They're just wonderful people, and wonderful monks, and great teachers. So you gave them a chance, and see what happens. Obviously, if you're gay, no sexuality at all. I remember talking to this man. I said, look, what happens if someone comes into the monastery and it really turns you on? What would you do? And he said, I'd just go back to my hut and just lie down. They had their strategies because there was a danger there. And they did perfectly well, and I'm just so proud of them. And so, if you're gay, you can become a monk. Or a nun or whatever. And there's another person, he was schizophrenic. And I thought, you know, you can't meditate with schizophrenia. I always thought that, but he did it. Great guy. So, you know, he got ordained as well. So, no, sometimes the boundaries, you don't say, this person can't. You're too old, or you're too sick, or you're gay, or you've got this, you know, problems or whatever. We give them a try and see if they can make it. And I'm just really inspired and impressed that, you know, some people I thought, no way can you live a life as a monk. They've done it. They proved me wrong. So always give people a chance. We have heard so much about your cave kuti at the monastery. Would it be possible to view the kuti sometime tomorrow before we leave Perth in the after retreat evening afternoon? Thank you. That's what happened the last retreat, the BF retreat. That's with the Singaporean group. The last day of the retreat, they all walked over to my cave. It's only a cave. It's only sort of some rocks and a space in between. But yeah, if you really want to, you can. Ajahn Brahm, does deja vu have any connection with past lives or recollections? Thank you. Wow. I think I dreamt of reading this question out yesterday. No, I didn't. But you know, many of you have deja vu, and it's really weird. I don't know how it actually works. But I think some psychologists say it's not really deja vu. There's some sort of thing comes up. You believe you've seen it before, but it's not the real thing. But it appears that way. So be careful with some of the mind, how it works. So I don't think it's really connected with past lives, because it's usually you have a deja vu of, you know, of something which has just happened. Just like reading out a question, or you're in a meditation, or it can't be from past lives, because this meditation hall wasn't here in the past life. Wrinkles, grey hairs, I'm finding it hard to accept. Any suggestions? Yeah, Botox. No, I don't get Botox. Wrinkles, grey hairs, I'm finding it hard to accept. Any suggestions? Yeah, just let go of the body. It's not yours anyway. Anyway, you know, as I say, I think I told that joke, didn't I? Rodney, you know all my jokes about the two old guys. Yeah, I think I said that the first night, didn't I? The two old guys sitting on a park bench and... Yeah, okay. So, you know, grey hairs, wrinkles. Actually, if you really want to sort of get rid of that, is actually shave all your hair off and become monk. Because also, not only having no hair, when you do have wrinkles as a monk and you look very old, it gives you this, you know, this idea of you being wise. And so the older you are as a monk, you know, the more sort of a sage you are, you know, the more sort of closer to enlightenment. You've got this old, wise old monk. So, you know, the older you get as a monk, you know, the more popular you become. And that really scares me. You know, because I'm only 58, I'm going to be really busy by the time I get to 68. And the worst thing about being a monk, you know, you can't retire. The older you get as a monk, the harder you have to work. You know, the oldest person in the world right now is a monk in Phuket. He's the one who's, how old is he, 113 or 415 or something? He's the oldest man in the world in the Guinness Book of Records. And this old monk in Phuket Island, 115 years of age. Before you were a monk, you were a hippie in the 60s. Well, sort of. Did you ever experiment with pot or other mind-defining, altering substances? Go on, you can tell us. The relevance of this is that, what does he say? I smoke but never inhaled. So that was, who was that? That was Bill Clinton. Okay, yeah. No, actually what happened, that many of my friends in school, they were getting into marijuana. I think I tried once. But then what happened was my best friend, you know, he got caught by his parents smoking marijuana. And I remember being on the bus with him and he said, look, this is ruining my whole life. And I was just so tough at home. And I just thought of my father. And he was really sick. And I thought, gee, if I get caught, this is going to kill my dad. And that time I stopped. I never took any more. It was only like once or twice, a couple of puffs. But nothing really happened. But once I found out my father was so sick, I thought, you can't do that. So it was actually just, you know, the love you had for your father. And because he was very vulnerable because of his sickness, you didn't want to cause him any extra problems, because he would have worried about you if you're smoking marijuana. So that's actually when I stopped. And then when I got to university, you know, that was actually more people were smoking things. That's when I got into meditation. And the meditation teacher said, "Don't, you know, if you're going to meditate, you don't take alcohol or drugs." So I was still taking an alcohol for the first year, but then I gave that up. But no drugs, because I thought, I don't need it anymore. So that's actually my own story. I was actually very fortunate, because some of my friends, they really got into it big way. At that time, I remember we always used to say, oh, it's just, you know, recreational, and it doesn't lead to anything harder, but it did. Now, I went to this, you know, really top school in West London. It was all scholarships, you know, scholarships from just the local primary school, which had a lot of migrants in it, into the sort of this top school in West London. So I had all these amazing brains. One of my best friends, Adam, he was also at Cambridge studying medicine. He got kicked out of Cambridge because he was a heroin addict by that time. And the last I heard from him, he was just mowing lawns for, you know, just getting some money. And from who could have been this incredibly good doctor, you know, helping many people because of his heroin. That's what started it. And off another friend, you know, in my year, many, many years ago, he was in jail for dealing heroin. Another one was known all in West London for actually distributing marijuana under different names. So, you know, a lot of my friends really got into it in a very bad way. And I was actually very fortunate that these were my friends, the people you were hanging out with. But it's because of, you know, my love for my father, and then later on coming across Buddhism, I never got into that. Could have done it very easily. So I was very fortunate, because as a young man, you don't know what you're doing. You're following your peers. You're rebelling. And this is what happened. So, the relevance of this is that I feel very chilled but lucid, somewhat like being stoned back in my own misguided heyday, except this is why it's better. Exactly. Because, you know, this way is much, much better. You can be much happier than, you know, taking alcohol and drugs. You've been around me a long time. You know, sometimes people think I'm taking drugs. No, what are you on, Ajahn Brahm? I remember this one occasion. It might be a bit late tonight because you've got a lot of questions. Shall I tell them? Do you mind being a bit late? Yeah. On this one occasion, I was in England, and one of the monks, he started off this Buddha Grove project, so putting Buddhas in different open prisons in the UK. And this was the first one which was done in Spring Hill Prison. They got a big Buddha statue. Each is actually to get it donated from some many Thai supporters. Got permission to put it inside a prison, so it's a place for peace, quiet, and reflection. We got a small one now in Carnot Prison Farm, which we did. The monastery organised it. A place of peace and reflection, so people who have done some crimes can go there and just feel relaxed and feel some forgiveness. So it was the first time this was in UK prisons. There it was. I was invited to the ceremony. Like many of the ceremonies, we do circumambulation 3 times. And, you know, I easily get inspired. I thought, this is great. A Buddha statue, a beautiful one inside a prison. It's going to really help so many people. So I was just so inspired and happy. That there's 2 prisoners. They weren't really in part of the ceremony. They had nothing to do. They were just on the outside, just looking. And I saw one of them turn around, you know, from the corner of my eye, and he said to his mate, "That monk," pointing to me, "he's on the gear." Because, you know, they recognized my smile. They thought that can only be drug induced. And it wasn't. It was just out of inspiration. I want to pass on my sincere thanks to the nun for her clear and comprehensive answers to last night's question. It didn't say Ajahn who, but it must be all 4, because they are a team. In the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the Buddha teaches his 5 former companions the middle way, not falling into extremes of indulgence or asceticism. However, when you read the biographies of the great monks of the Thai forest tradition, Ajahn Mun, Ajahn Tay, and so on, they do the Dutanga practice of fasting and solitary practice in the wilderness, extreme to the average layperson. Does this make the middle way relative to the individual practitioner ability and temperament? Thank you. Now, look, I know those monks, not Ajahn Mun, but the other monks. I went to stay with them. And this is just the exaggeration which people do to their teachers. It's called, actually there's a word for it in English, hagiography. So it means your teacher. Say for example, Ajahn Brahm, when I die. Then you start to sort of exaggerate. You know, sort of, I remember that. No, I did a 6-month retreat. I remember that time Ajahn Brahm did a 6-month retreat. He didn't even get out from his meditation cushion for the whole 6 months. That's totally false, but, you know, we actually expand it. And I remember the time he read my mind. And I remember the time he flew through the air. I remember the time, because we like to build up, because that's my teacher. And my teacher is better than your teacher. And this is actually what happens. And some of the stories in these books, they focus, you know, on the hard thing. You'll say, Ajahn Brahm, he had to eat rotten fish curry every day. That's really tough. And so the actual fact of the matter is that many of these monks, when you go to see them, are just so relaxed and peaceful. It wasn't tough. Because, you know, they got born on rotten fish curry. That's, you know, what they like. That's like the fish and chips of the Northeast. So it wasn't sort of hard for them. In fact, it was much harder being in the village because you had to work so hard. And in those places, you can sit and sleep, and it was much nicer. And they didn't do much fasting. So when you really look at it, actually how they really did live, it was actually quite a comfortable life. It was a middle way. So this is just the exaggeration you have in books, because people like to build up their teachers and build up their sort of their favourite monks. But I was there and I knew how they lived, and they were fine. Being content and finding peace in the present moment seems to me to be at odds with wearing this life of suffering, or wanting this life of suffering to be over. Is there a tendency with the latter to be a bit detached from life, with its responsibilities and its beautiful moments? It also makes me feel that it is somehow wrong to love my husband and children deeply. Yeah, it's always a tough one, because, you know, how can you relate to some of the things which you're doing here to actually some of the attachments you have at home? And it is a difficulty. So, which is why that when a person does have a family, you know, you have to sort of do those responsibilities, even though you feel that, well, you know, just what am I doing this for? You know, just being with a wife, having another kid, and then another kid. Just how many kids do you have to have? And, you know, oh, they're so sweet and nice. Yeah, but they cost a lot of money. You got no freedom. The more children you have, the more of a prisoner you are. It's just another bar on your cell window. So. So people think, Ajahn Brahm, you're a monk, you know, you're really weird. But that's actually, you know, how you look at it. So what you do here, even if you've got lots of family responsibilities, you come here and have a bit of time off, you do get some peace, you do get some tranquility, you get an idea of what's possible. But you have to go back to that family, you have to do your duties and responsibilities. And sometimes people come and they say, I want to be a monk. And so you've got family and children, say, yeah, I've got a few kids. You look after them first of all. If that's the degree of your responsibility, you're willing to abandon your family, you're not going to be a responsible monk. So you do that first of all. Look after your family, make sure they're all well looked after and enough financial security, or your children are sort of mature enough, they don't really need you around anymore. Fine. But before then, no. So you have to do your responsibilities. And beautiful moments, yeah, of course there's beautiful moments in life. There's also a lot of worrying moments, a lot of difficult moments, and some moments where you think, gee, how can I get through this? So that when you learn how to find peace in the present moment, you've got something which will be there for you even in the lay life, in the difficult moments of your life, painful moments or tragic moments. All you learn here, you'll find will help you enormously in your life. Tomorrow morning I would say more about practicing in the lay life, but it actually does happen. Who knows, and one day maybe, you know, when your family grows up, you will be able just to maybe live the last years of your life in a monastery and actually do some more practice and take this more deeper. This is a beautiful lifestyle, being a monk or being a nun, and you really can get so peaceful. So if you can do it, it's highly recommended. Ajahn, after this retreat, and if we still have questions to our meditation, how can we post the questions to you? The monkeys in my mind are very naughty, so I'm sure once we get home and there's a possibility of stealing these monkeys, I will have questions. So what you should do, you should write the questions on a piece of paper and then put them in an envelope and then write to me with love for me. And there'll be your address on the bottom, and post it to yourself, because the only one who can really answer your questions is you. Ask the question of yourself, because really that's the only one who can truly find the answer. All a monk can do is give his idea. All a nun can do is point you in the right direction. You're the one who has to find those questions. And in the end, you have to make the mind still. And only in that stillness can you find the answers for yourself. That always has to be the best way. So, you cannot have my email address. You cannot post things to me. Post it to yourself. Like, how many of you are there? And how many of me? How on earth can you answer all these questions? It's impossible. Thank you so much for your inspirational talks. Now that I know the proper way to meditate, I will get into the jhanas and try my very best to destroy the 10 fetters in this birth. If I fail, I'm going to ask for my money back. That's not what they wrote. If I fail, I hope I find a good Ajahn like you in the next birth. I remember hearing somewhere that the Buddha said how difficult it is to get a human birth. So I must at least destroy the lower fetters. Ajahn, you have made me see the unsatisfactory nature of any kind of birth. Ajahn Bhan Wangso is the greatest Ajahn in the 21st century. Isn't that nice? So, no, it's not quite true, but thank you very much. After seeing the Dhamma, does one know it was for the first time, or is the knowledge coming out of jhana the same each time? What does one have to see exactly to get on the way out? See non-self. So there's no one in there, that's the way to get out. And you don't really know it was for the first time unless you get previous lives seen. Can those on the spiritual paths other than Buddhism reach enlightenment? That was a question asked to, by Subhadda of the Buddha just before he passed away. The Buddha gave a brilliant answer. Can other people in other religions get enlightened? Can those on spiritual paths other than Buddhism reach enlightenment? He says, as long as they're practicing the Eightfold Path. Anywhere you find the Eightfold Path being practiced, there you will find people becoming enlightened. It doesn't matter what you call the religion, it's what you're doing. So if you're a Buddhist and you're not practicing the Eightfold Path, you're not going to get enlightened. If you're a Christian, you call yourself a Jew, you call yourself anything, and you're practicing the Eightfold Path, then of course you get enlightened. It's not what you call yourself, it's what you do. So just thinking, I'm a Buddhist, I'm going to get enlightened. No way. You've got to actually practice the path. You know, right view, right intention, speech, action, livelihood. You know, the energy and the mindfulness and the stillness, the jhanas. You've got to practice it, and then of course it happens. When I see people shave their hair and renounce, I'm so happy and joy for their courage to do that, but I know myself not ready yet for renunciation. That's a hypocrisy. And still crave for the worldly pleasures. What should we do to be more ready to renounce? Please advise. Get into a jhana. And then you're not really interested in all this worldly stuff anymore. So yeah, people are happy. But sometimes, especially if you're an Asian, Malaysian or Singaporean, Chinese especially, you're very, very happy to see someone renounce, shave their hair and become a monk or a nun. As long as it's not your own son or daughter. Some people are like that. In Chinese culture, sometimes I think it's bad luck, you know, that your son becomes a monk. There must be something you did very wrong that your daughter wants to become a nun. It's a shame on the family. Please never think like that. It's a wonderful thing for the family that one of your relations, a son or a daughter, has become a monk. You feel so proud. Another thing, if you hear any parent saying, I don't want my son to become a monk, I forbid my daughter become a nun. You tell them for me that stopping someone doing good karma is your very bad karma. One of the best karmas you can do is to become monk or nun. So anyone who stops someone becoming a monk or nun makes huge bad karma. So if they want to become a monk or nun, you let them. Otherwise, if you stop them, ooh, you're in big trouble. Regarding the two cases of heart transplants you mentioned last night, is it possible that the mind is very closely linked to the heart? Not really, because the mind is just separate from the body. It can make use of the body, make use of the brain, yeah?
There's actually a case where someone had a liver transplant
and a liver, sorry, not connected to the liver either. So they had a similar experience. It's interesting, isn't it? There must be sort of some sense of ownership. I think it's more like a ghost. You know, because they have a sense of ownership for their possessions, and they especially influence you, especially at night time. So I reckon it was like the ghost of the previous people, because those two stories I read out were people who actually died violent deaths. And many transplants come from like accidents, you know, murders, you know, executions in China, whatever. And these are sort of things which have very violent sudden deaths, which means actually the organ is very easy, or much more easy to actually to give to somebody else. So I think there's a lot of transplants come from traumatic people who died in traumatic circumstances. And that sometimes ghosts come from that. When a stream of consciousness exists, the human body at death, or exits the human body at death, does it linger for a few days before it merges with the nimitta, or does it move on immediately? You know, it can stay around for a few days. And that's, of course, where we get our ghosts from. So, you know, sometimes if you die, it lingers on for a while. And I remember this. Now, in our monastery over in Thailand, I'll tell you a ghost story. At our monastery in Thailand, there was a cremation ground. So maybe, you know, once a week or sometimes two or three times a week, you'd have bodies being burned. It was out in the open. You could actually see, you know, the head explode and all the stuff come out. You could watch it. And the Thai people were so terrified of ghosts. Especially, you know, you knew that someone had just died that day, the chances of getting a ghost were actually quite high. So we have one of these small little novices in our monastery. And he was so scared of ghosts. But this was that night, we stay up all night meditating. Now that novice would usually, you know, stay up to maybe 9 o'clock and then he would just go back to his hut and sleep. We didn't mind, he was only about 11, 12 years of age, and he was a young guy, and he wasn't sort of up to sitting all night, but that night, he didn't dare go out of the hall. Because, you know, going out to his hut and going through the dark, and he was terrified of the ghosts, he'd much more endure the pain of sitting and not sleeping than maybe having an encounter with a ghost. However, when he got to 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, he couldn't stand it any longer. He had to go to the toilet. So he steeled up all his courage. He got to the door and made a dash for it. And the toilet was maybe about 40 meters away, 50 meters away. And he got in the toilet door, lit the candle and closed the door. He had to go. And that's when he heard the steps. Coming towards the toilets. Right in front of his cubicle. And then he heard. As this thing started scratching at the door. And that little novice, I think he evacuated all his bowels. And he stayed in that toilet for 2 hours apparently. Until the sun came up and he could get out. Oh, did you hear that? And afterwards, you know, he came and told us what had happened. He said, the ghost came, I heard it, it was scratching, trying to get in. And the monks, we burst out laughing, because we know exactly what that was. It's this little civet cat, it's a possum. You know, and it would always come in the evening. And you know, these sort of the Asian toilets, the squat toilets, you have a bowl of water there, he's just coming in for a drink, that's all. He would come to that toilet every evening just to get a drink. All he was doing is coming in there, let me in, I want some water. But the novice didn't know that. The ghost is coming to me. And he was so scared. So anyway, but when a stream of consciousness does exit a human body at death, it does linger on for a few days, usually. Just to make sure everything's okay, then it goes away. Dear Ajahn, please explain bowing and Anjali. I'm relatively new to Buddhism, and honestly, it seems silly and reminds me of Christianity. Sometimes when I'm inspired or respect a teaching or feel uplifted, I do that, but other times I don't, and I don't want to do things out of ritual or because everyone else is doing it. I can't. Should I lower my ego? Maybe you can inspire and change my view about this. Oh, what bowing is just you're lowering your head, so, you know, what you sort of is above you, you're actually respecting. And everybody does that, even in Western culture. I learned to bow when I was a kid. You know, you go on stage or you do a performance and you do a bow, you do a curtsy. All it's really doing, like a salute. It's just actually lowering your head a little bit, saying, I really respect this. It's a beautiful thing to respect things. So I really get into these days. I love bowing to things. But what I'm saying, every time I bow to, say, a Buddha, I'm not bowing to a piece of metal, I'm bowing to, was it virtue, peace and wisdom, or sometimes virtue, peace and compassion. I really worship those things, which means every time I bow down, I remember virtue, goodness, ethics. That's so important in my life, and I really worship that. So every first time I bow down, I worship virtue. Second time, I worship stillness or peace. It's such a wonderful thing to have a peaceful mind and know how to make everything still. It's one of the most valuable things, and I worship that. I love holding that high. Yes, stillness and peace is really important to me. And lastly, wisdom and compassion. I put those two together. And that's just such a wonderful thing. If more people were wise, if more people had compassion, what a great world this would be. So I bow down to wisdom and compassion. I worship them. I know every time I do that, I remember what I'm doing. What that does psychologically, it reinforces those qualities inside of me. Because I make virtue, peace and compassion really important, I remind myself of that every time I bow. Those qualities grow in me. That's why I bow. I bow to those qualities, which means they grow in me. So as long as you know what you're doing, it's a fantastic thing to do. And doing the Anjali is just respect. You know, again, it's almost like not praying, asking for anything. It's just saying, I really respect you. It's a wonderful thing to do. So try it, and you know, you find you have a sort of a sense of beauty if you do it for the right reason. And it really works. But you don't have to. It's okay if you don't want to. Uh-oh. I have found... This is interesting. I have found my true life partner here in this retreat. We eat, sleep and do everything together. She always gives silently and selflessly without asking anything in return. If I'm kind, gentle and contented with her, she will show me all the ways to truth, to peace and to happiness. She has made me a much more peaceful person now. I also learned about her three other friends, Mr. Sam, stillness, Mr. Vip, right mindfulness, and Mrs. Mehta, right effort, with their friendships. My life is filled with loving kindness, joy and understanding. Thank you, Ajahn, for revealing... Ah, now I see what you mean. Your true life partner here in this retreat. We eat, sleep and do everything together. She's always giving silently and selflessly without asking anything in return. Thank you, Ajahn, for revealing my true life partner, Mrs. Breath. She has been with me all these years, but I was totally negligent and unmindful of her existence. Yeah, she fooled me there. I thought, my goodness. A couple of you have fallen in love and gone back to each other's rooms and canoodled, broken all your precepts. But no, it's brilliant. Well done. You fooled me there. Your true life partner, Mrs. Breath. So it shows you're a man. A man must have written that, but anyway, or Mr. Breath. Thank you for your excellent teaching. Would you say it is possible to attain those deep levels of meditation and lay life without the opportunity for continuous restraint and practice such as during this retreat? Do extra precepts help? Sometimes people actually do fluke these jhanas. One of the reasons why I teach like this is sometimes people, they have these experiences in their day, you know, in ordinary life, and they just don't know what the heck has happened to them. And a classic story that when I went to Penang, teaching retreat over there a few years ago, they asked me, can you please do some counselling for this woman because, you know, she's crazy and no one else can help her. But she's not really crazy, it's weird, no one knows what's happened to her. So, you know, I'm always ready to do things like that, so they brought her in and she described what was going on. And I was listening and I thought, my goodness, I know what you just had, you've had a jhana experience. It was classic, it was dinky dai, 100%, she had all of these sort of trademark features of it. But she hadn't heard about jhanas before, so she didn't know. And, you know, her experience when she did it to a psychologist or a psychiatrist, they had no idea. And she thought she was crazy, losing her body and just, you know, having lots of ecstasy and just couldn't hear anything. And afterwards, she was just in just such a beautiful state. And it was a classic description. I said, "Madam, you just had a jhana." I said, "What's that? I did a few more days." "Yeah, exactly. That's what it was like." And so she went away just such a happy person. She realized she wasn't crazy or mad because I understood what she'd gone through. Now, how she got into there was just, you know, one of those times she really let go and she got into a jhana just by luck, more than anything else. But at least I could explain what it was. And I've had many cases like that. So because of that, I like to teach everybody so you know what these things are. So if they happen to you or happen to a friend, you get a good understanding of what's going on. And sometimes they do happen just... sometimes almost spontaneously. So that's why it's important to know that. It's unlikely. The only time you really get into it is on retreats such as this. So it's hard at home, but sometimes it does happen. So at least you know what to do and what it is. You just let it go and enjoy it, nothing more. Sometimes when my mind is still enough to be free of thought, different emotions arise, some of which are quite subtle. For example, like anticipation, which I may turn into impatience. I find I can easily recognize these subtly different emotions and have tried to investigate how I recognize them. Now I recognize them, but I can't. I only know what they are. So how do I know, or should just keep trying to investigate to discover the answer myself? Your mind is still enough to be free of thought, but different emotions arise, some which are quite subtle, like anticipation. These are the sorts of things that when you get into a deeper state of meditation or mindfulness increases in power. It's just like turning off up the lights, so you're not in a dim state anymore. You're very, very light and very see things very, very carefully. You can actually see more. And that's when you can see much more of this emotional world. You can understand the different types of emotions. You don't need to name them. But, you know, anticipation, expectation, there's a whole range of emotions there. So you can see them, but you also see how they work. How they take you away from the present moment, how they spoil the peace. You start to notice all of that. And by noticing it more and more, you soon get the insights, and the insights change the way the mind works. So you see these things, not as interesting things, but as enemies. You just don't want them anymore. In the same way, you don't have to know that snake is dangerous. You see one, you run away. So when you see these negative emotions coming up, your mindfulness is so strong, you can see them coming a long way away. They don't catch you, you can avoid them with ease. So that's actually what happens. Just keep on going, and those emotions like expectations, you'll soon recognize them as the sort of things which they may look like they're going to help you, but really they're just causing you too much problems. If the very act of observing affects the object of our observation, how do we avoid affecting controlling the breath? It's a very difficult one, because as soon as you see something, you do interfere with it. That's Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. So if you're watching the breath, it's so tough to be able to watch the breath without interfering with it. But it can be done. All you need to do is just to be so still and just look at the breath like a friend, so you don't control it. It's just the way you look at it. So, I don't know if I gave this symbol the first time, but yeah, did I give the symbol of taking your friend out to a coffee? Imagine that you got your, now after the retreat, so now some of the people here, you've met them in the same room together, you say, look, we're going to the airport later on today, but we've got time for coffee, let's go into town and have a coffee together. Now if you take your friend out for coffee, what do? Do you tell your friend, you're going to have a latte, no sugar, and it's going to be with soy milk, no milk, and you're going to sit at this chair, and I'm going to sit on that chair, and you're not going to talk, I'm going to do the talking. And, you know, you're going to pay, I'm not going to pay, you're going to have sort of a muffin, a blueberry one, not a chocolate one. And you don't talk to your friends like that, you don't order them about. But that's how you watch the breath. Come in, go out, slow down now, slow down, calm, what if you come? And don't talk, I want to be silent. So if you treat a friend like that, they will never want to have a cup of coffee with you ever again. You say, let's have a cup of coffee. Say, oh, I'm just busy. I've got this important appointment. And that's why your mind runs away from you. Why you can't watch the breath, because you treated it so badly for many years. But imagine you have a friend. You say, let's go to have a coffee together. You know, which one do you want to go to? Do you want to go to sort of a Dome or a Gloria Jean's, or where do you want to go? He said, oh, I really like Gloria Jean's. Okay, I know where there's one. And you sit them down. What table you'd like to sit at? Outside, inside? Now, what do you want? No, I know, I really like the cappuccinos in this. But he said, oh, I prefer a latte. Okay, I'll have a latte as well, if you're going to have one. Do you want something to eat? And you just allow the person just to be at ease with you. And of course, if you have a friend like that, you love having coffees together. You love hanging out together. So if you can treat your breath like that, like a good friend, you don't tell it what to do, you just hang out together and enjoy each other's company, then your friend will never run away from you. There you are, it's the breath and you meet together. Hey, do you want to hang out together? The breath said, oh yeah, yeah, I'm into that. Breathing in, breathing out, I'm watching you. Yeah, this is a great time we're having together. You don't force it, you just watch it as a good friend. Yeah? The extra dimension which really has the calming effect is not the observation, it's the compassion. One of the things I said at the very beginning of the retreat, mindfulness together with kindness. Mindfulness alone just disturbs things. Mindfulness with kindness calms it down. So if you are watching the breath, it's with that kindness, what I was mentioning, like as a friend. So whatever you watch in life, yeah, you're aware mindfully, but be kind as well. Even if you're doing a sweeping of the body, you're mindful of those feelings, that's not good enough. You have to be kind to them as well. Mindfulness and kindness, mindfulness and metta. Then it's just so good. And that works. So when you are mindful of the breath, or mindful of the body, or mindful of anything, add that metta to it. You from Singapore, MM, the head of the government in Singapore. It doesn't say he's the head of the government, but we all know that he runs the show. MM, that's Lee Kuan Yew, Minister Mentor. So that's not really MM, it means mindfulness metta, MM. Ajahn Brahm. It is a tradition in some Buddhist countries, since like Sri Lanka, where monks tie a pirate thread around one's wrist. It is true that this thread, which is stretched in front of the monks who chant pirit, might vibrate to the sound of pirit. However, at the end of the pirit, there aren't any more vibrations in this thread, except maybe for a few microorganisms which may have settled down on the thread during the chanting. According to Ajahn Manindo, in one of his books, he refers to this as Mahayana tradition. Whatever it may be, doesn't this give out one a false sense of security? When Ajahn Chah was pestered by a government official for good luck charm, he applied saliva on the official's head, the general, yeah. Recording one of your stories, Ajahn, there was a case of a major in the army who got himself shot to death because he was so confident enough to believe that his very expensive charm Buddhist medallion would stop a bullet. That's actually in the newspapers here. He bought this Buddha medallion for $1 million. Now, some of the generals, this was in Thailand, must be corruption big time over there, because he could afford $1 million. You don't get that on a general salary. $1 million little medallion at the market. And the reason he got that, because it was going to stop any bullets. So he was in the officer's mess. He'd obviously been drinking enough Mekong by now, the whiskey. And he got out his revolver and gave it to his junior officer. Shoot me. I'm going to prove this medallion. It was an order. And so junior officer had to follow orders and shot him. Killed him dead. And at the inquest afterwards, it was because, everyone saw this, because he had so much faith in this medallion, which he paid $1 million for, he wanted to try it out, and it didn't work. What a waste of money. Since of late, this white cutter thread has now become multicolor with so many cutter strands that now it's more like a bracelet. Kindly express your views about this. With reference to Kalama Sutra. Okay, these pirate threads. Anyone got pirate thread on their wrists? These little wrists? Yeah, you got pirate thread on his wrists. So, does that work? Sometimes you get lots of it. Sometimes it may work just to give you a little bit of confidence, an uplift, like a moral uplift, and that's sometimes why we do it. But really, it's just your belief in it is maybe all of really what's there. There's nothing really inherent in it. So it's just one's belief in these things. That's why people who sell this stuff, it can be white, it can be sort of... Actually, wasn't it Madonna getting into this with some orange Kabbalah thread? So all sorts of people get into this. But I remember just this one lady, when I was giving some out, she said, can I have a longer piece? I always remember this story, it was a Thai girl. She said, about this long. I said, you can't sort of tie it around your wrist like that. It's too long. It's for my husband. Even he's not got a wrist like that. No, it's not for his wrist. It's for his neck, and I want to put it tight. What she's saying there? Really good joker. But my pirate thread story is, the Sri Lankans were like this. It was a Saturday at Nolamara, Dhammaloka Center. And one of the Sri Lankan boys came to see me and he said, look, I've just come from the Wacker, that's the cricket ground. And that day, the Sri Lankan cricket team were playing a one-day match against the Australians. They said, the lunch break, Sri Lankans were doing really badly. And they were getting desperate. And the word had come out, is any monk here could give us some pirit thread for our wrists? So, I'm just a nice, kind monk, even though I know it's just a waste of time. I made 12, because I knew there was 11 plus the 12th man. So I set it down to the Wacker cricket ground in Perth. and Sri Lanka's lost. It was a bit too late, but that's not the story, because this was a warm-up match for the World Cup cricket. And that was the time when Sri Lanka won that World Cup. And who did they beat in the final? Australia. And that was huge celebrations throughout Sri Lanka, as you know, you would know. And the captain, Ranatunga, he was the cricket captain then, I saw in the local paper, front page, because this was a big thing, you know, sport in Australia is more important than any religion, he was holding up the World Cup, the World Cricket Cup, and there was celebrations all over Sri Lanka. And that's what I noticed, because his both arms were up, my string. That's why they won the World Cup. And if Australia had found out why they lost, I'd have been kicked out of the country. So I only told that story quite a few years later on. I remember meeting Ranatunga's mother and I told her that story. She laughed her head off. Ajahn Brahm, early in the retreat you requested that people do not start packing to leave before the retreat ends. Could you also please request that people keep noble silence right until the end of the retreat? While others around are talking, whispering, it is difficult to retain the sense of solitude, which I, for one, would value for the whole of the 9 days, having come a long distance to this retreat. That's a good thing. The retreat only finishes at 2:30, hasn't finished yet, so keep the noble silence. After the retreat is finished, you'll have more than enough time to talk. And the rest of your life you can talk, but how often can you actually be silent, such as keep it quiet, and enjoy it to the very end. Last question, thanks for waiting. When I perform an act of generosity, I normally wish to realize the Four Noble Truths and attain Nibbana. Is this also an expectation I should let go of? Of course, because if you don't realize the Four Noble Truths and attain Nibbana after giving an act of generosity, you will want your money back. That's actually, if any of you ever get one of my books, especially the meditation book, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, I promise people, this is my meditation book. All the stages of meditation, how to become enlightened. If after reading that book, after 12 months, you don't become enlightened, you can ask for your money back. That's my guarantee. Reading that book, after 12 months, you don't get enlightened, you can ask for your money back. You won't get it back, of course, but you can always ask. There's always a catch in it somewhere. So when you do an act of generosity, it's great not to realize the Four Noble Truths and attain Nibbana, just give. And then Four Noble Truths and Nibbana come to you. Okay. I'll do the last little story for tonight. This is one of my favorite stories. I haven't said it yet in a retreat, but I usually say on every retreat, because you're trying so hard to get enlightened. And I mentioned the story of Ananda, just putting his head down and letting go. But my story about that is the donkey story. And so many of you know that, but it's a great story if you don't know it. Donkeys are the most stubborn of animals. That's why we have the phrase in English, as stubborn as a donkey. You can hit a donkey with a stick, and the donkey won't move. The only way you can get a donkey to move is actually to give it some sort of treat in front. So instead of actually hitting with a stick, you tie the stick to the donkey's back, so the front of the stick is about 2 foot in front of the donkey's head, tie a string on the end of the stick and a carrot on the end of the string. So the donkey sees his carrot 2 foot in front. Then it will start moving because it wants the carrot. And so it will move towards the carrot because that when it moves, the stick moves, the string moves, the carrot moves. So as the donkey is following that nice juicy carrot, the carrot is always 2 foot in front of the donkey, and the donkey moves, and it can pull the cart and the people and everything. That's how you get donkeys to move. Just like we got you to move. And the carrot was, you know, jhana, 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 jhana. You find that no matter how much you try, it's almost there, isn't it? You can almost get it, but it's always just a little bit too far in front. However, the donkey, once it learned Buddhism, Buddhist donkeys always catch the carrot. And how do they catch the carrot? This is how Buddhist donkeys catch the carrot. They run like hell after that carrot. But it doesn't matter how much, you got it, how much they run, how fast they run, the carrot's always 2 foot in front. But then the Buddhist donkey knows how to stop. Make peace, be kind, be gentle, and be patient. Because as soon as they stop, that carrot starts to go away from you. It doesn't come towards you at first. That's why when you start letting go, sometimes you get tired and sleepy, don't you? And some of you said, I've slept more than I've ever slept before. When you let go, your mind goes crazy and start thinking of these things. Something's going wrong, it's not working. Patience. That carrot can sometimes go further away than it's ever been before. 4 foot from your head. It's only been 2 foot off. How could this be working? But you're patient. Because then after it goes as far away as it's ever got, something strange happens. The first time this has ever happened to you, the carrot starts coming towards you. Remember some of you guys said, just you let go, make peace, and the breath comes towards you. And when that happens in meditation, you're just letting go, being peaceful, and the breath comes. That's such a nice breath. It's so easy to watch. You don't go chasing it. So the carrot starts coming towards you. And it comes quite close. Just, you don't go looking for nimittas, they just come. It's just there, it's natural. And the carrot comes so close to you, to the donkey, all you do is to remember not just mindfulness, but kindness. The door of my mouth is open to you, carrot. And it comes in. That's how donkeys catch carrots. And you've all been running like hell long enough in your life. Now you just need to stop. Let go. Make peace, be kind, be gentle, and be patient. Wait in the moment. And sure, when you start Ajahn Brahm's type of meditation, first of all, I think, it ain't working. I used to do Vipassana, I used to get somewhere. I just watch the breath, breathing in, breathing out, you're getting somewhere. But, sure, the carrot is not 4 foot away, but it never comes to you that way. You've got to stop and let go. Carrot goes further away, I understand that, it's going to happen. I'm going to have lots of sloth and torpor, lots of restlessness at first when I let go, so I'm not controlling my mind. Then it starts coming towards you. And that's the fun part. It comes closer and closer and closer. And all these stages, they happen to you. You don't go chasing anything. You're just sitting here. I also give a simile of like on an aircraft. On Buddha air. On Buddha air, you just sit down. You do nothing. Sit down in your seat. And the flight attendant comes and says, Madam, would you like the delightful breath? It's the first course today. So, oh yeah, I'll take some of that. And then they come down a few minutes later. Sir, would you like nimitta? We've got white nimitta, yellow nimitta. How about the deep blue, psychic blue nimitta? Oh yeah, I'll have psychic blue, please. A few minutes later they come down with a nice trolley. Sir, which one would you like? First, second, third or fourth jhana? And said, well, fourth, like third is, it's one of my favourites. Thank you, I love third jhana. And they give this nice third jhana and just have a wonderful, wonderful time. And later on in the flight, they come around and say, we got on offer special, just for today, for special, last day of retreat passengers, we've got stream winning, once returning, non-returning, or full enlightenment. What would you like today? Well, I don't really want to get full enlightenment, because I've got to pay off my mortgage here. I've got to go to work. So I'll just have stream winning, please, today. Very good, here you are. These things all come to you. You just sit there. And that's how it happens. Or, I'm going too much far, but Ajahn Chah's story. First year in Wat Pa Phong, before Wat Nana Chat was built, he started saying, this monastery is like a mango orchard, like Jhana Grove. It's a mango orchard. And all the trees were planted 2,500 years ago by the Buddha. And those mangoes are ripe. They're dripping from the trees. You don't have to throw a stick up. You don't have to climb the tree. All you do, put out your hand and a mango will drop in. It's a brilliant simile by Ajahn Chah. Totally crazy the first time I heard it. Because I've done that in mango tree, a mango orchards. Put my hand out, nothing's fallen. If a mango does fall, it falls over there somewhere, never my hand. Crazy stuff. But of course now you understand what he's talking about. Don't do anything. Don't climb the tree of enlightenment. Don't shape your mind. Just put your hand out, open it up with kindness. And be still. And all these beautiful attainments will fall into your hand. Delightful breath, nimittas. Just sit still and it will fall into your hand. Jhana's enlightenment. That's how it works. Brilliant similes from one of the great masters of the 21st century, Ajahn Chah. Okay, so there you've got all the information there. So just put your hand out. You can put your hand out. And wait all night. Okay, so thank you. So sorry it went on for a long. It's 9:40 now, but it's the last evening. And of course we had lots of questions and I can't keep them until tomorrow. So there we go. If you've got energy, carry on. If you want to meditate in your room, meditate in your room, whatever you want to do. Remember, tomorrow for many of you, the retreat will be over. Your last chance. See what happens. But don't push too much. Don't think, yeah, this is it, I'm going to get Nibbana or else. Because that sort of attitude is not letting go. Okay, so have a nice night.